what our technology can do for our industrial partners is eliminate the production of the waste, make it potentially easier to develop a project domestically. I would say actually there was a light bulb moment where the kind of combination of chemical reactions that you would need to put together to make the whole process kind of occurred to me. And then we decided to go in and actually set this thing up on the lab bench. I have had to learn how to give pitches, how to sell an idea. I feel hopeful because the magnitude of the problem is massive, but the magnitude of the industries that we're tackling are also massive.
This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. I'm Dave Tabor. This episode is with Laura Lammers, PhD, founder and CEO of Travertine. Travertine is another amazing Colorado clean tech company. Its Travertine process captures CO2 from the world's largest industrial processes, and then through science, or maybe it's magic, the CO2 is mineralized for permanent storage. I'm not sure if I even said that right, or if I did, how I did. So that's just one of the many reasons I'm excited to have Laura Lammers in studio with me.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you will get a chance to fix what I said wrong. But in the meantime, hey, others are excited about Laura too. Listeners, Travertine just a couple of months ago raised a second round, this time $8.5 million from investors, including one of the world's largest cement manufacturers. So somebody thinks you're doing smart things. Laura, yeah, first question. Before you even get into the science and the business of Travertine, what's the problem you're solving?
Well, so the extraction of raw materials that we need for our day-to-day lives produces massive quantities of chemical waste and also generates huge amounts of emissions. And so we're working to commercialize a new technology that's powered by electricity to eliminate or dramatically reduce the production of those wastes while at the same time taking advantage of rock's ability to permanently sequester carbon dioxide.
Okay, so you say some of the world's biggest processes. I mean, I didn't realize this till recently, but one of the biggest polluters is the production of cement, like for buildings and stuff like that, right?
That's right. Yeah, so cement production involves burning limestone, effectively, and that releases a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. But it turns out that if we take ores that are processed in mining operations to produce critical elements, we can actually turn the residue back into limestone and resequester that CO2.
All right. So when you say important minerals, you're talking about products that we're using in things like computer chips and batteries and things like that, right?
That's exactly right. So all of the metals that we need to make batteries, rare earths to make magnets, all of those things come ultimately from rocks. And mining is the process of getting those out. And mining creates a lot of residue that we can sequester carbon dioxide into.
Yeah. So aside from capturing CO2, how else are you managing pollutants?
Yeah, so let me take a step back and try to give a simple explanation for our process, because it can seem complicated, yeah, but it's really at its heart quite simple. And so what we're doing is using electricity to power a process called electrolysis, which is taking water and splitting the molecule apart. And when you split it apart, you make acid and base. And the way that you get metals out of rock is by reacting rock with acid. So we take the acid we produce, which is called sulfuric acid, use it to extract valuable products like phosphorus for a battery. And then we take the base that's also produced, use that to capture carbon dioxide from the air, recombine that with the acid leach residue, and that gives us a permanently sequestered mineral carbon.
So that means that what would have been CO2 released to the air is actually captured in the process, and then it becomes like a mineral. It's trapped in a mineral form.
It's even better than that. We capture CO2 not from the extraction, but from the air itself. So we capture the CO2 from the air itself and then put it in the mineral form.
So before it's actually released into the air, during this process, it's captured. Or is even before that. It's before that.
Yeah, our technology is actually a form of direct air capture, which is different than carbon capture and storage. And so I know there's a lot of terminology floating around related to carbon management. And there's a distinction between capturing carbon dioxide from the air and capturing it from a point source where it's released by an industrial process. So our technology actually does capture from the air rather than point source capture.
All right. So I'm going to let that go for now.
Okay.
Because, I really do want to understand. So let's say you're using sulfuric acid, you're treating a mineral to extract another. And so where does the CO2 then get captured?
So we actually blow air through a fan across a caustic, which is a form of base, an aqueous form of base, and that captures the CO2 from the air. So we have this little caustic air capture system where air goes in one side, and what comes out the other side is carbon dioxide depleted air. And then all that CO2 ends up in a chemical that we then react with the ore residue to make that permanent mineral.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like kind of a holy grail.
Yeah, we think it's a pretty elegant solution to a really complex problem.
Because even carbon sequestration, to my understanding, is you're capturing carbon dioxide and pressurizing it, not you, but whoever's doing it, is pressurizing it into a liquid form and then injecting it typically underground into a cavity where science says it will stay liquefied because of the pressure. Mm-hmm. But it's still CO2 essentially.
That's exactly right. And actually, that's where my career started. When I started as a PhD student at UC Berkeley, my research was on geologic carbon sequestration, which is what you just described. So it's taking CO2 from the air or from a point source, compressing it, putting it underground, and then seeing what happens. Turns out that the oil and gas industry pioneered this technology back in the 70s with enhanced oil recovery. And, you know, there's very... It's a pretty safe technology in the sense that there's relatively low risk of catastrophic release of CO2 from those geologic reservoirs. And over time, that injected CO2 does turn into minerals, but it's a much slower process.
Got it. Too bad that carbon can't turn into diamonds, right? But so figure that out next.
That takes a lot of pressure.
You'll get more than 8.5 million if you do that. So okay. Now, without getting too deep, there are actually four solutions your company delivers, and I kind of wanted to talk about all four of them, but I want to do it without getting way too deep. But the first one is eliminating waste and creating value. The second is carbon negative sulfuric acid, carbon removal and permanent sequestration. We talked about that a little bit, and green hydrogen too, which is sort of a cool thing these days. So talk about those.
Yeah. So those are all components of our core process, which we call the travertine process. Our core process is three parts. So the first part is, like I mentioned before, it's the electrolysis. So we take a salt and we split it into acid and base. And the acid is actually the most used chemical in the world. It's called sulfuric acid. And it's widely used in extraction of metals and other elements from ores. We then take that acid, leach an ore, and that salt that's produced from that leaching goes back into the electrolyzer. So that's where the waste elimination comes in, is that sulfate waste gets recycled back into the acid as a core part of our process. The next part is the CO2 capture. And that happens in the second step in our process, which is the caustic air capture. And that's where we get the CO2 out of the air. And then finally, the third part is the conversion of that CO2 into a mineral. And that's where we get that permanent sequestration. So we actually form a physical product that is chemically identical to limestone.
Which means it's also very similar to what goes into concrete manufacturing, right?
Exactly right, which is why we're so excited to work with Holcim, which is one of the world's biggest cement manufacturers. They can actually take a pretty big proportion of cement and replace it with a fine limestone, which is what we make, and that reduces the overall carbon emissions of cement production.
So that means, too, you could be building a parking structure with sequestered concrete one day.
That's right,
or
exactly.
Or sequestered carbon.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Well, that's kind of cool,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally.
All right, so how big, everybody talks about how huge this problem is of CO2 in the atmosphere and so forth. I mean, how much of it could you travertine, even as you scale? Like, can you make a dent?
So I feel hopeful because the magnitude of the problem is massive, but the magnitude of the industries that we're tackling are also massive. And so there are a handful of industries that include the cement industry and also the mining industry that are moving material at the same scales at which we need to remove and sequester CO2. And so that's exactly why we chose this process as a commercial process for carbon removal.
So in theory, if those industries, steel's another, if those industries got on board and were investing the way, say, Holcim's investing with you, if they really took a chunk out of what they're doing, it makes a big difference overall in climate change?
Yeah. So if I could give you some specific numbers, sulfuric acid is the most used inorganic chemical in the world. There are about 250,000 tons produced today, mostly from fossil fuel refining and used. If we replaced all of that conventionally produced sulfuric acid with a recycled acid that our technology produces or other competitors' technology produce, then that would allow us to, number one, eliminate close to 500,000,000 tons a year of chemical waste, and number two, remove and permanently sequester over 100 million tons per year of carbon dioxide. And those are big numbers.
Are they? What's 100 million tons of CO2 look like? Seriously, nobody uses these numbers. Like, would it fill a school? I mean, a pool? Would it fill a huge building? What is it?
Yeah. So, okay. So that starts to get daunting. But again, humans are moving material at this scale. So a billion tons of carbon dioxide. Wait, no, hold on. 50 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which is the annual emissions of humans, would translate to something like 100 cubic kilometers of limestone, which is a very large amount, but it is an amount that we actually move.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So we'd have to start building a bunch of carbon sequestered buildings to make up for all this, right?
Well, I mean, we're already producing 8 billion tons of cement every year globally.
So you'd have plenty of demand.
I believe, yeah, absolutely. There's plenty of demand for our core product, which is sulfuric acid, and also the products that we make with the acid.
Got it. All right. I'm going to take a deep breath here and thank sponsors. You've done a good job in helping me understand this. And you are listening to ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast the last 4 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today is Laura Lammers, founder and CEO of Travertine. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, Kinsley Meetings, and Kinsley Meetings is ProCo 360's longest-running sponsor. They've been growing their business over many years with a reputation of handling really complex meetings all over the world. I spoke with Steve. They're doing great. You should call them and see if they can help you. Also, Via Technologies, thanks for hosting ProCo 360, all the great help your team gives me with the significant amount of data and all the trouble I cause for you guys. Thanks to you. Also, Colorado Biz Magazine, our partnership is one of building our audiences together. And Denver Angels, we're partnering with them to feature great Colorado companies. Go to ProCo360.com and check out all of our partners. So back to Laura. I mean, you are, obviously, at this point, you're a scrappy startup. You're pledging to fix the world's climate change problems. And, you know, I know that you just raised $8.5 million. But, I mean, how far can that go towards, you know, taking a chunk out of this problem?
Well, we're going to need more capital than $8.5 million. But I'm heartened by the fact that conventional industries that use sulfuric acid are also they're already deploying huge amounts of capital. So, you know, a full commercial scale plant that uses sulfuric acid to produce something like phosphate for either batteries or for fertilizer is going to be costing $1 billion. And so it's not a question of are we basically coming in with a totally novel technology that doesn't exist trying to create a new market. Rather, we are trying to enter an existing market that's already deploying capital at scale and making the simple request of folks to deploy it to us rather than to the conventional modes.
So instead of, they'd have to, as they scale up and they build new factories, they'd have to invest in some kind of production one way or another.
Exactly.
Yours is a problem-solving production method. Do they have to do this ultimately? Do they feel compelled to do this? Do their shareholders make them do it? Do their bottom line compel them to do this? Or are they just trying not to get regulated more heavily than they are?
I think The reason we developed this technology is that it solves a problem for industry, and that problem is, for them, it's waste. Today, you know, you don't have to pay for carbon emissions, so that's not really their problem, but their problem is managing the waste they produce in conventional extractive modes. And so what our technology can do for our industrial partners is eliminate the production of the waste to make it potentially easier to develop a project domestically. A lot of the production of raw materials for renewable energy technologies has gone offshore. Nobody's going to be surprised to hear that. A lot of that's because of the environmental downsides.
And offshore, they don't have to really absorb those kinds of caretaking costs.
Exactly. Our US EPA has the most stringent environmental regulations almost anywhere in the world, which I think of as being a good thing. And it requires industry to be responsible. And so potentially these types of technologies would allow us to onshore more of those extractive processes.
Wow. And so it's jobs, it's economic impact, it's also strategic, you know, globally strategic benefit to being able to do this.
Yeah, showing leadership in decarbonization.
You're saving the world.
Well,
in many ways.
we want to play a small part.
That's cool. Now, okay, so you're a geochemist PhD. So what is that?
So geochemistry is the study of a field that really runs the earth. So geochemistry is the study of natural chemical processes. These types of chemical processes regulate everything from the quality of water that we drink to the amount of carbon dioxide and oxygen in the air that we breathe. And so, you know, literally everything to do with the surface environment that we live in, how it evolved over time, really is studied in this field. And so anyone on this listening to this podcast who's in school, going to school, should take an earth science class, should take geochemistry.
You know, you make it sound a lot more interesting than any class I ever took. When I studied like geology or whatever, it was like, this is that rock. This is this rock. It was formed, you know, 100 million years, 100 billion years ago by this. And that. It was like so boring. I don't think anybody drew, maybe there weren't the connections already that exist today that you're just, now, is the travertine process that you have defined or harnessed, is that a natural process that you discovered, or is it a process that you invented?
So it's kind of a combination of an invention and mimicry of a natural process. So the reaction of CO2, which is actually an acid, with rocks is exactly what regulates carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over 100 million year timescales. That's something that we've discovered as geochemists writ large, not me, but my more forebears, I would say. And so what our process does is uses industrial processes like industrial electrochemistry to make it much faster. Hmm.
So when you thought of this process, were you actually trying to solve a problem? Did you just discover it? How did that happen?
Yeah, so this came about from a conversation I was having with a CEO of a lithium company that was standing up a mine in Nevada. And you'll be hearing news about this company. I won't say exactly what it is. But they were developing a new mine, tackling this issue of sulfate waste with their conventional extractive process. So they were using sulfuric acid to extract lithium, generating waste. I was hearing about this problem thinking, well, they're in the desert. There's a lot of sulfur around in this form called gypsum, and then thinking about my lab experiments at UC Berkeley, where I was a professor, and this idea kind of clicked. We tried some proof of concept experiments on the lab bench. The process worked, and then we kind of ran from there.
Well, when you say it kind of clicked, did you think, like, when you thought, hey, we could do this, were you pretty sure, or were you just screwing around wondering?
Well, I knew that the chemical reaction would work. I knew that we could convert gypsum into calcium carbonate, but I didn't know that it could be done in an economical and scalable way.
Ah, got it. So that was really it's the process that makes this work. If you couldn't do it economically, it wouldn't matter.
Absolutely. If we can't deliver a product that's at close to cost parity with what's coming off conventional process today, it's really hard to compete, particularly when there's not a lot of certainty around carbon markets.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to I think, pay you a compliment. I'm going to compare you a little to Thomas Edison because I got a story to ask you. I know, I got a story. But there's this story of Thomas Edison that, you know, he tried to invent the light bulb, but he got it wrong like 1,000 times. And then he had this flash that said, I see the problem. And he fixed it right then. He fixed it, and he knew he had fixed it before he even did it. Like, was that part of, like, did that happen to you?
I would say actually there was a light bulb moment where the kind of combination of chemical reactions that you would need to put together to make the whole process kind of occurred to me. And then we decided to go in and actually set this thing up on the lab bench. And that's one of the coolest parts of being an academic is that you have the luxury of all that equipment around and we can just do it.
Yeah. See. So, I mean, when you went in, is that something like, oh, you woke up at midnight, you went in and ran in and it was done at like 3 a.m? Or is that like, was this something that took like a month?
It took more like a month. But, you know, the moment of inspiration, kind of getting it all down on paper, that, you know, that's a matter of hours, right?
Really? Yeah. And did you know it? Like when you were writing it down, you're like, this is going to work.
I knew that the chemistry would work. I didn't know that we could make it commercial. And that's still the process of discovery we're on.
Ah, yeah. So talk about the name. Actually, Travertine, I looked it up. Yeah. And I mentioned to my wife, she goes, travertine tile, of course. But no, I mean, I looked it up. It's a form of terrestrial limestone deposited around mineral springs. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. So where did the name come from, though?
So, it actually comes from, if you've ever been to Yellowstone National Park, the Mammoth Hot Springs, that's a form of travertine. I think it's one of the most kind of charismatic geologic formations that you'll ever see.
Charismatic. this is what PhD, it's like, what, geology porn for you.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, you go there, you visit, it's just incredible to see. They're beautiful, kind of layered features. It's an example of a naturally forming carbonate mineral, really kind of evokes the beauty of these natural geochemical processes.
And so that's why you named?
That's why I named it travertine.
Got it. Good. Yeah. So this is going to take us a few minutes because I'm really curious. How does a geologist who is teaching turn into an entrepreneur?
Well, you know, as an academic, you always have to consider impact and research and the process of discovery has its own form of impact, but of course the audience is relatively narrow. And, you know, what I was learning from my PhD students was that there was a kind of a world beyond academia where we could actually translate our fundamental geochemical principles into new technologies that could actually transform the way that we make materials.
You know, the thing that I wonder is how does somebody who's doing bench work, studying for a PhD, probably being a TA, like how do you become an entrepreneur from that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I went all the way through to becoming a professor at UC Berkeley and had to make the tough decision to leave that position to start this company. And I think, you know, anyone who goes in the field of science is doing it for the love of discovery, but also many of us want to make an impact. And so translating that science into something useful is something that you don't get to do as much in academia.
Yeah.
And my PhD students were showing me that there was a path to actually translating our work into application.
Because it seems like in grad school, people I talked to, like they were there teaching because they didn't really connect with the real world. I mean, maybe they had come from the real world and this is how they were like spending the later part of their careers. But, you know, there seems to be a disconnect between most academia and, you know, making something that will solve world problems.
Well, I have to say that, again, I think most academics want to do their work to make the world better in some way. And the way that they do it is by making fundamental discoveries that could have transformative impact on the planet. In geochemistry, a lot of the fundamentals are there. Basically, everything we need to solve the problem of climate change is well understood. And now it's incremental improvements to be able to improve efficiencies and make it cheaper. Mm. And so I wanted to be part of that transformation.
You think science will solve global warming when human behavior won't?
I think it's got to be a combination of regulation, which
regulating human behavior,
which can influence human behavior, and technology. You know, there are many examples of where regulation has improved our quality of lives. You know, anything from CFCs depleting the ozone layer, those getting banned, and actually the ozone layer repairing itself. And so there's precedent for humans making huge changes based on our new understanding of the science. It's well understood that CO2 in the atmosphere is causing climate change, and we have the tools to solve it.
Yeah. What about, you know, when you said it was a hard decision to go from teaching to becoming an entrepreneur, like, what was that process? Like, how did you even, first you have to decide you've got something that's actually going to become a business that can pay the bills and that is worth pursuing, right? How long is that process?
Yeah, well, I think there's actually more similarities to academia and entrepreneurship than is generally appreciated. So
for sure. I'm raising my hand. Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, when you're running a lab, you need to tell a story and convince funding organizations to give you money to actually pursue the questions that you have. You have to build a team of students and manage a laboratory. A lot of times you have to do your own administration of grants. And so all of those skills are really translatable to entrepreneurship, particularly at the early stages. And so early stage entrepreneurship is going out there and selling an idea. And so, you know, put together a pitch deck. Somebody showed me the nitty gritty of that, but it's not much different than writing a proposal.
You know what's different though? Is speed.
Yes. Absolutely. And I love that part about entrepreneurship is that you can go so quickly from coming up with an idea, testing it out, pitching it to potential investors, and then actually building a team to solve a problem and make a difference.
So how long did it take? First of all, I mean, you had to talk to your husband and say, I'm going to quit my job, or were you doing both? I mean, what was that? Did you flip a switch that said, okay, I've gone from being you? How did that work?
So just full disclosure here, my husband is also an entrepreneur, so I got the, you know, a little bit of the bug from him. But, you know, the kind of basic science of this I've been working on for most of my career, which is carbonate mineralization, turning CO2 into a mineral. The actual...
More fun to talk about it now at parties, isn't it, than then?
Totally. Way more fun, yeah. People get it more, for sure. But, you know, really going from that first idea to a set of experiments, that took, you know, a month, you know, getting that first paper out, maybe a year. And then the decision was, you know, it was like, well, it looks like this is going to take off, but I need to put my whole self into it. And so I had to make that hard decision to step away from my academic job at UC Berkeley and move to Colorado and start this company. So once we did that, it was a couple months to bring in that first capital, our seed funding round. And now we've been at it for about 2.5 years.
Wow. That's quick to raise $2 million. You must have been talking to people before you actually left, right? Yeah. If I left, would you be there? Would you want to help?
Yeah, but of course there's no commitment.
No.
You know, like
there's
no certainty until... literally until the money gets wired into your business bank account.
Ah, yes. So what was, you know, you mentioned there's some similarities between academia and entrepreneurship. I'm somewhat, you know, like speed is a huge difference. I know. So is the motivation of having investors knocking on your door, wondering when they're going to see the next result. But what is a specific thing you learned, maybe painfully, that's different about your job now than it was when you were an academic?
Absolutely. So to be an entrepreneur, you need to be producing a commercial product that the market wants to buy, which means that a big part of the job, particularly as a CEO, is sales. And so I have had to learn how to give pitches, how to sell an idea, and how to sell a product.
How's that feel?
I never thought I'd be a salesperson, but here we are. You know, and again, you know, it is similar in some ways to academia because you have to convince people of something, and a lot of kind of getting traction for ideas is convincing. And so, there are similarities, but they're definitely different in practice.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that in a second. Start thinking because I'm going to ask you that. I'm going to remind listeners first. This is ProCo 360. Best Colorado Business Podcast the last 4 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs, like the one of my guest today, Laura Lammers of Travertine. Go to ProCo360.com to subscribe to the newsletter, read my blog, link to sponsors, and catch the books I'm listening to on Audible. So thinking about sales and the process of having to convince, I mean, here you are talking to me. I don't know much about geology. Your investors, some probably do though, don't they? Your best investors probably know a lot about your subject.
Some do. I think investors are really good at going deep on a topic for a short period of time and building a thesis and then making investments around it. And so generally, they're really smart people. They may not have specific expertise in the technology you're developing.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm always curious when someone says, I never pictured myself doing sales, because I've done sales my whole life. And you know, our mantra is nothing happens till a sale is made. And I guess in your case, nothing happens till the sale is made is the funding.
Definitely. At this point in our company's trajectory, our most important need is bringing in the capital to finance the demonstration plants and then the first commercial plant. And so all of that has to do with, number one, de-risking the technology, and number two, establishing the markets, and number three, selling the product.
Yeah. So what's de-risking?
De-risking?
Yeah.
Talk the about technology
that. Yeah, de-risking the technology. Talk about that.
Yeah. So de-risking is kind of a fancy word for testing it out, making
proving
sure it works.
Proving it, right?
Exactly.
So that people know if they invest and you scale. That's the tricky thing, because some things that work at a small, like in a lab, do not scale. And no matter, like, you can't multiply it times 1,000 and get 1,000 times. It just doesn't work that
way. Totally. Yep.
I don't understand why.
Different reasons for different technologies. I think one of the advantages for scale up for our technology is that two of the core unit operations, the electrochemical unit operation and the CO2 capture operation, are basically modular. And so we're able to test at a commercial module scale in our R&D facility in Boulder. Hmm. And so there is much less technical risk in scaling up a modular technology than there is a much more scalable technology.
And a modular technology means essentially you bolt them together and
exactly.
You get 2x, you get 5x, whatever you're bolting together.
Exactly.
Oh, cool. All right. So why'd you move to Colorado to do this? Because you said you had to pack up and move.
Yeah. So it was a combination of personal and professional reasons. So I have three little kids. We were thinking about where we could go to raise a family, but also be able to pursue our professional ambitions. And we decided that the Front Range was actually a perfect place, a great place to raise a family that loves to go in the outdoors. And then also an amazing confluence of the types of expertise that we need for our specific technology. So we've got the School of Mines here.
Yeah.
You know, there are very few top-tier mining institutions in the U.S., and one is here. There is NREL. There's NOAA. You know, there's all kinds of research institutions that bring top-tier talent. And there's also the mining industry where you get the really top-tier engineers.
Yeah. And I would think that investors, you know, they look at you and they say, she's willing to move. Her family's going to uproot itself. They're going to move to where I mean, that's one more vote of confidence for you, don't you think?
I mean, it takes a certain amount of grit to move three small children halfway across the country.
Yeah, and
sure.
It shows commitment, right? I mean, it shows you're committed to making this work, which is really, you talk to a lot of venture capitalists, they want to see the science, they want to see the proof, they also want to see commitment.
Sure.
Quitting her job, moving to where it's best, right?
Yeah. That's, and I mean, I think a big part of a successful startup is going to be perseverance and pushing through those tough times.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Last couple of questions. I mean, I asked you earlier about sort of making that transition but I mean, you must have had mentors that have done this before, that people that you talk to that have gone from academia into entrepreneurship. What did they tell you?
You know, I actually didn't have a lot of examples from my training of people who actually made the leap from academia to entrepreneurship. It's actually more rare than you might think. And a lot of academics think that academia is like the, you know, that's the be-all, end-all, right? And so for me, I got some really great mentorship from a person named Peter Fisk, who I overlapped with when I was a faculty scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And he told me about this novel idea of customer discovery, which is a fancy way of saying you should ask people questions about what their problems are. And so that's what led me to the conversations with mining CEOs, where I said, well, you know, what are your biggest problems with extracting lithium? And they said, well, it's all this waste we're making. And I said, well, maybe we can solve that. Yeah.
Really? So you were thinking sort of on an entrepreneurial path when you were asking those questions way back when?
Well, so the reason we started out the customer discover process was actually in service of science. We were trying to put together a research consortium for critical elements in the U.S., but it led me to something that actually could have commercial viability.
Yeah. That's cool. So what do you wish you had known then that you learned the hard way?
How to power through giving the same PowerPoint presentations 100 times.
You know, that would be exhausting. I mean, it's easy to have the energy the first few times.
Yeah.
Is it really hard to have energy the 100th time?
I think it's not hard to have energy. I mean, that's what coffee's for. It's hard to have conviction 100 times, right? And to really convey conviction, even if you feel it deep down, but to bring that enthusiasm, that's the hard part.
I could see that. That makes sense. Did you really have to do it 100 times?
I'm sure I've done it at least 100, probably more than
that. All right. So when someone comes knocking on your door, an academic, and says, Laura, you've done this, what advice are you going to give them?
I would say, you know, be prepared to do things that are not comfortable to you, like standing in front of a bunch of people and selling something, right? I would say it's going to take a lot of perseverance and an ability to power through the no's, because you will get rejected.
But if somebody told you that, you would have said, got it. And you wouldn't know what that meant at all.
Yeah, some of it is just living it and experiencing it. But I think if anything, more academics should trod this path, because there are so many great ideas coming out of science that end up, you know, in a paper but never turn into reality because nobody actually had the conviction to take it through and test it out as a commercial idea.
You think there are world-saving discoveries that just haven't been pursued?
I'm 100% sure of that.
Wow.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So what advice do you have for yourself today that you hope you'll follow?
I would say, you know, to keep feeling hopeful and to remember that the foundational technologies are there. Now it's just a matter of achieving commercial scale. So it's really a reminder to be hopeful and a reminder that we can solve the climate crisis.
Wow. That's quite a note to end on. Let's wrap up. It's been fun to talk with you about this. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, today on ProCode 360. You've been listening to my conversation with Laura Lammers, founder and CEO of Travertine. Laura, it has been an interesting conversation. I look forward to watching you, not just build Travertine, but also I want to check in with you periodically and find out who you've inspired to do the next one.
This has been really fun. Thanks for the great questions.
Oh, it has been. Thank you. Listeners, glad you're here on ProCode 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCode 360 podcast. If you haven't yet, it's a huge help if you follow the podcast and submit a review. Thanks again to show sponsors Via Technologies, Kinsley Meetings, Denver Angels, and Colorado Biz Magazine. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.